Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host for today, Carla Nappi. I recently had the great pleasure to talk with Philipp Kitcher from Berlin. He's in Berlin right now, and he joined us via Skype, about his book, Science in a Democratic Society, that came out with Prometheus Books in 2011. Now, this is a very ambitious, very rich book that speaks to not just the philosophy of science, but also science, technology, and society, the ideas about democracy, what it is, what it can be, how we ought to think about it and define it. And it speaks to also the field of science education in a way. He has really interesting ideas in this book about curricular reform, about what it can look like for the public to learn about and inform science with a capital S. And it's just an extraordinarily clear and very compelling read. We had a great time talking about it, and I hope you enjoy the interview. Hi, Philipp.
Hi, Carla.
We're here today to talk with Philipp Kitcher from Berlin right now about his book, Science in a Democratic Society, and that came out with Prometheus Books in 2011. Now, this is a book that I'm very excited to talk with you about. It's extraordinarily rich, and I think the consequences of this work and of not just the theory, but the very specific suggestions that you're putting forth have really wide-ranging importance, not just for the sciences or science with a capital S, but I think for all of us who do some kind of research that we might consider in relation to translation of knowledge or broader public impact and sort of really thinking of ways to engage that relationship into the most basic elements of what it is even to conceive a research program and think about what it looks like and what it can look like to pursue that. So thanks very much. And thanks for making the time to talk with us about it today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your interest. Thank you for your enthusiasm. I just want to add to what you just said is that it does seem to me that anybody who's doing research ought to worry about how they contribute to wider social goals. I follow Dewey here, who thinks that people who pursue investigations are, in fact, part of a social division of labor, that they have something to contribute. And I think all people who do research ought to be reflecting on the nature of the contributions that they make or might make.
Absolutely.
So I think that the reflections that you were suggesting that might apply to those who think of themselves as making an impact just apply to everybody, because everybody should think of themselves as potentially making an impact.
Absolutely. And I think this one of the great things that this book does for a reader engaged with these ideas is to encourage us to think about this, not just at the stage that many of us do, which is, you know, you're sitting down with your funding application, you've got that section, broader impact, how do you justify after you've already decided what you want to work on, but really incorporating that into the very fabric of what you think about as, you know, your job as a researcher in relation to society.
Back.
So, Philipp, can you start us off by saying a little bit about what brought you to this particular topic of science and democracy? And I know this is a broad question and you've been working on this for some time, but is there anything that sticks out as particularly germinal for you in beginning?
Well, it's a long process. I'm a very slow learner, and it takes me a long time to change my mind about things. And some of my critics over the years probably would like to have seen me make progress faster than I have. It's taken me a very long time to move away from the kind of philosophy of science in which I was originally trained towards a more socially embedded and socially relevant view about scientific research. And that really began in the 1990s when I was asked if I would advise the Library of Congress on the Human Genome Project, and that led to a book called The Lives to Come, which was about the impact of various new genetic technologies on human life and human society. That got me rethinking things. I then wrote a book, Science, Truth, and Democracy, in 2001, and that extended things further, but I was still being, in a way, dragged, kicking and screaming into thinking about science as socially embedded. And over the course of the past decade, that sense really dawned on me in a way that I might have picked up earlier on. I might have picked it up from other people in science studies. I might have picked it up from my friend and fellow philosopher Helen Longino, for example. I mean, there are people who were doing similar sorts of things from whom I might have learned more quickly. But I hope I eventually got the message. And so my views have evolved, really, during the course of the first decade or so of this century. And from when Prometheus Books asked me to write a book for them, I wanted to do this. I wanted really to bring this set of ideas to fruition, to try to get a sense of how I thought that science should function in a democratic society, to clear up some misunderstandings about science, about democracy, about their relation, and also to attend to some very important specific problems that I see us as facing.
Mm-hmm. And are there specific ways you can point to or that sort of stand out for you in which your thinking about these problems has evolved from the time when you published Science, Truth, and Democracy in 2001? And I ask specifically because you do mention this in the book as sort of a starting point or an important point, at least, along the way to developing what's in this book.
I would say that Science, Truth, and Democracy sort of rather reluctantly backed into a domain. It started with issues about science and truth, and then it said, oh, by the way, there's this other sort of stuff that needs to be contended with. That came to me to seem more and more unsatisfactory. I began to see that the idea of science and values is something that might be tacked on at the end of a book or a course or something like that. It's just the wrong way to look at it. Values and science is the way to look at it, okay? And so the values come first. And partly this was the result of some work I was doing at the same time on thinking about ethics as a naturalistic human endeavor, and that also fed into it. Partly it was also the result of getting to know more about various kinds of scientific disputes and scientific kinds of possibilities. I've been much influenced over the last decade by reflections on the debates about climate change, and that's become more and more a central part of my thinking about science and its role in society, about genetically modified organisms, about the role of biotechnology in society, about the ongoing controversy about evolution, etc., etc., etc. And it seemed to me that I needed a much more systematic way of thinking about all of the aspects of examples like these, and that was, I mean, I just feel that we as a, not only as a nation, but as an intellectual community worldwide, have just been held by a very misguided and distorted picture of scientific activity.
Mm-hmm. And mentioning the importance of the fact that this is a study that very explicitly speaks to problems worldwide, so not just in America, not just in the U.S., I think is a very important part of this as well. So this is not just about science and democracy as sort of a implicit code for science in the U.S. This is very much a study that very explicitly engages global context, if we can talk about the global.
Exactly, exactly. I don't think any society's got this right. I think there are particular problems in the United States that come from particular sources of distrust, but there are sources of distrust of similar nature in other countries that have, rich scientific research.
Right. Right. Absolutely. So this is actually a perfect way to get us into the body of the book. The introduction starts off by, and I'll just sort of lay this out very briefly for listeners, proposing that the book is going to look at the problem of integrating expertise with democratic values. And these are two clusters of themes that are going to persist throughout all of the chapters of the book. You lay out for us four major causes of this problem, this complex problem, and we'll talk about these or many of these in the context of the chapters as we move through the book. One is an oversimplified idea of science as being somehow value-free or being ideally value-free. Another one is a conviction that, as you say, fruitful discussions of values are impossible. Then there's a third issue of an oversimplified idea of democracy as just involving, I think you said, when people go to the polls and emerge waving ink-stained fingers in the air, and that's an image that's going to stay with me. And then finally, and this is something that is going to occupy us for much of the book, is a failure to understand that the system of public knowledge is contingent. And really sort of the importance of pointing to a system of public knowledge as being crucial to how we think about values and science and the importance of this for any kind of democratic society.
That's a very good summary. Those four.
Well, it's mostly your summary. And it's one of the great things for listeners who haven't had the opportunity to read the book yet. And I think you should, for listeners out there. It's a book that's very firmly a philosophy of knowledge, of science, of democracy, but it's written in an extraordinarily accessible manner. And the argument is very, very clearly laid out all along the way. And so it's extraordinarily accessible. You don't have to have any philosophical training to be able to get a lot out of this book. Now, as we move now to this particular elaborations of these initial problems that you set out, or these factors that you set out at the beginning, one of the things I want to ask you, there are a number of thinkers and works that repeatedly emerge over the course of the discussion that seem, at least from the citations here and from your discussion in this book, to have been formative in some way in shaping the way you think about these problems. And you've already mentioned Dewey. I'm thinking specifically of Evelyn Fox Keller, comes up a lot. Conway and Oreskes' book, 2010, I think comes up a lot. Can you talk a little bit about some of the major influences that you found in shaping the ideas that ultimately took their final shape, or at least took a concrete shape? Who knows if it's their final shape, but took shape.
Well, one is large parts of the science studies movement over the past 30 or 40 years. I mean, I learned an enormous amount from Thomas Kuhn and successors to Thomas Kuhn. Kuhn was probably the person who got me interested in doing philosophy of science in the first place when I read his The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, now 50 years old, and it made an enormous impact on me. But I spent a lot of the early part of my career, in a sense, fighting with him, because I was reading the book in a very narrow way, as most philosophers of science did. And the same goes for the sociology of knowledge movements, for various movements in feminist thinking. I mean, there's been a tendency to overreact, say these people are vulgar relativists, they don't have any place for scientific objectivity. I haven't abandoned scientific objectivity, but I have come to read people like Kuhn, like some feminist scholars, like some people in the social studies of science movement, more charitably than I did earlier, to see them as really advancing important things. Perhaps they have sometimes been unclear about what they were doing, but I've found more value in their work recently. Partly that's the result of the extraordinary influence of Dewey on me. Dewey's pragmatism has made just a huge impact on me over the last decade. And I owe that to a very great philosopher who became a very dear friend, Sidney Morgenbesser, who died, as you probably know, some years ago. But in the years immediately before his death, I talked with him extensively on pretty much a weekly basis. And that was really, really helpful for me in developing some of these ideas. And now I owe a lot to a lot of people. One person whom I think perhaps I haven't given enough credit to in the book is a young woman philosopher named Heather Douglas, who I think has made really very good case for the limited character of the value-free ideal in science. So I regard myself in this book as not, as it were, sort of going completely originally in a new direction, but articulating themes in the work of a lot of people who've come before me, perhaps in a way that wouldn't be entirely obvious unless you've made the kind of intellectual journey that I've been making in the last decades.
Mm-hmm. I think that that the importance of that theme also resonates in the content of what you're saying, as well as in the method of how you're saying it. This idea that progress in knowledge making is not about autonomy, that we perhaps have this ideal of thinking and research as this autonomous, individualistic kind of endeavor. And that I think one of the important points that comes up throughout the book is the importance of cooperation, the importance of dialogue, the importance of conversation and empathy. And I think what you're describing right now in terms of your methodology and the kinds of influences that are leading you to make this is a perfect example of that.
Well, thank you. But one thing I would say is that, and this relates to your fourth theme about the contingency of public knowledge, is that I have come to think about research and about scientific work in a completely different way. I mean, the Royal Society of the 17th century set itself up to be men, privileged men, because if tradespeople were admitted, then they might be motivated by vulgar motives like making money instead of pure curiosity. So a small group of privileged men were going to find out things about nature that interested them. They could never have foreseen, and their contemporaries could never have foreseen, that there would be this institution in the 20th and 21st centuries, science, which would play such an enormously vital role in the lives of societies, of nations, of individuals, and so forth. And yeah, this idea of, as it were, disinterested curiosity and my doing the things that I want to promote has persisted into the 21st century. And I think we should have a different image. I think we should see researchers as part of an enormous team, as part of a division of labor, contribute something important to society, should acknowledge that, and that should actually be, in a sense, the foundation of the integration of scientific values with democratic values. That's the point at which expertise really has to be integrated with democracy, I think. We need to learn from one another, and we need, as it were, to be responsible to one another in the things we find out, ways we find them out, so that the information that each of us acquires is valuable for others. So as a vision of this is absolutely crucial to society, I think many of the problems that afflict contemporary democracies or the nations that think of themselves as contemporary democracies are problems that arise from failures of knowledge on large parts of the public, failures of knowledge sometimes on the part of everybody, failures of synthesis, failures of dialogue, and failures of certain kinds of responsibility for acquiring, certifying, and transmitting knowledge. That's what we want a system of public knowledge to do, so that the citizens can be well informed, and when they make their choices, they can make choices that further the things that they most deeply care about.
Right.
This became very clear to me, I must say, with respect to climate change, where, it does seem to me that if people really understood the risks that are being placed on their grandchildren, people who will live, say, 40 years hence, by the various kinds of practices in which we now engage, then they would get beyond this impasse at which we seem to be stuck and start a dialogue on how we might do something to meet those threats. Now, it might turn out that the economic consequences of taking those steps are themselves horrendous. That has to be, I think, admitted as a possibility. We should be trying to think systematically and seriously as a society about this, not either dismissing the problem or marginalizing it. So, and by a society, I mean it's the global human society. That's what I think. We've only got one planet, and we share it.
Absolutely. And one of the, it seems that one of the themes that recurs as a way to start to get there, and the climate change is one of the examples that you talk about, and you mentioned some of the others, evolutionary theory, biomedical research, worries about genetically modified foods, and so on and so forth. One of the ways that you talk about getting there is by creating a situation whereby the transmission of scientific knowledge to a broader public who are in the position to make informed decisions and have informed conversations is developed. So you raised the idea early on of the division of epistemic labor as one way to get here and as one principle and fact of democracy and democratic values. Can you say a little bit about that, this idea of the division of epistemic labor?
I think this is incredibly ancient. I think all societies get this. I mean, imagine a bunch of hunters and gatherers roaming around together about, say, let's say 50 of them. I mean, those who roam around the environment looking for roots or looking for water or looking for potential prey animals, whatever, surely report to one another on what they've seen. They have a responsibility to report sincerely and honestly. They've also got a responsibility to look for the things that are of interest to other members of the community, not stand there idly admiring the view, but to, you know, keep a lookout to see if there are particularly dangerous places where other members of their band might wander, or particular resources that might be useful. Now, that's very, very old. And this idea of expertise as distributed within a community has probably been inherited by all societies. And the problem arises when you think about this, a society in which, in a certain sense, each member has an equal say in what happens and has the right to put forward proposals about what should happen. How do you integrate expertise, individual bits of expertise, with that? It's not difficult in a band of hunters and gatherers. It's very difficult when the ways in which the society is threatened and the ways in which it has possibilities for the future are extremely complex, and in which individual experts may know something about that, or it may be only a team of experts from various specialties that together could know something about that. So it's that integration, stopping debate about something so that we can get on with the fruitful advancing of policy, and combining that with the idea that we all have a chance to express our own opinions in formulating policy. It's very hard, and it's very, very hard once you reach a situation, as we have done, where in many important areas, trust between the scientific community and the broader public breaks down.
Now, one of the components of the explanation that you just gave also shares some characteristics with one of the major points that you're making later on in the next chapter, which is this point that, and I'll ask you about this, for virtually all our history as a species, as you say, we've been engaged in an ethical project. Now, I'm going to ask you about what does this mean, this ethical project, in a moment, but before I get to that, What you just said shares with the explanation you give of the importance of this ethical project, is a reliance on and a place for an understanding of history and historical development as being a crucial part of the justification and the explanation of this system that you're giving us. And this is a particularly interesting point to raise, or this is a particularly interesting point in the book for those of us engaged in something like a project of making or trying to find ways to make history and philosophy of science speak to each other in a larger conversation. Because this is, it seems to be that what you're doing here is trying to use history and philosophy together as a way of speaking to each other. I mean, in what way do you find, and why do you find a history or a historical explanation as a component of thinking about these problems that's useful to you? What makes history important and useful?
It's a terrific question. It's also a terrifically complicated question. I actually think that the first sentence assumes the structure of scientific revolutions should be, as it were, you know, written up all over the place for us to contemplate as we go around the world. I'm going to probably misquote it, but it's something like this. History, if conceived as more than the repository of anecdote and chronology, might replace or might transform the image of science by which we are possessed. Okay, now I don't think that just holds true for science. I think it holds true for all sorts of areas of human practice, including ethics, democracy, the relations between science and democracy, lots of stuff. I think understanding the history of complex human social practices is absolutely vital. So I think, you know, Darwin was a wonderful innovator, but I think his most central insight in a historicist century was to say we can understand the character of living organisms in terms of their ancestry. Mm-hmm. History matters. I think history matters to our values. I think history matters to our understanding of our society. I think history matters in epistemological issues. I think it matters all over the place. And that's why I regret that often that Kuhn's wonderful promise of some sort of marriage between history and philosophy of science has been, you know, a pretty rocky marriage, if one's honest about it. So I think history is immensely important. With respect to the ethical project, I think that many people are, as you said originally, very worried about talk of values. And I think that those sorts of worries would be addressed, and we would understand more clearly how to talk about values if we had a clearer view of the history of the ethical project. So last year, after 25 years of working on it, I published my book on ethics, the ethical project, in which I basically argue that there's a certain kind of narrative that one can construct for the history of our ethical project, and that it has profound consequences for the ways in which we think about ethics. That ethics is a human construction, it's never finished, it's a kind of technology that originates in our need to get along with one another, that it's a conversation in which all have to be present. You can see the second chapter is there because it's an articulation in the context of this book of themes that are really important to my general approach, but also because I think this is a place in which one really can see how to get on with the business of talking seriously about values and then talking seriously about democratic values and integrating scientific values. Mm-hmm. Will we need to repeat?
No, it's okay. Maybe the last part about integrating. That's okay. There's a lot of cats and dogs who join the party in the New Books Network. My cat as well. Sometimes will meow her opinions. It's okay. So I think you were saying about the need to integrate. Just repeating the last part you just said.
The ethical values of science and democratic values and so forth. I mean, it seems to me that that chapter is basically a precis of some things I say in the ethical project, and that material is profoundly necessary for doing the sorts of things I want to do.
Absolutely. And one of the points that you make here that comes up later on for listeners, and then I'll sort of move us through, is an aspect of this ethical project that emphasizes the importance of mirroring others and the importance more broadly of sympathy I don't know if you put it in those terms in this chapter, but you do put it in those terms later in being a crucial part of how we, of really our ethical system, right?
Yeah. Okay. So roughly, here's the view. We have certain kinds of capacities for responding to one another, which probably we share with our remote ancestors and with our cousins. All of us can, on occasion, respond to another and do things that that work in the direction of cooperation with that other. But those capacities make it possible to have the sort of social lives that humans have always had, which is life in small groups with others, different sexes, different ages, and so forth. Chimpanzees, bonobos have that too.
Mm-hmm.
But those capacities are limited, and the limitations give rise to trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And we have escaped what is, I think, an evolutionary dead end for others, in that we've found ways of responding to one another that go beyond that, and those are integrated with our ethical discussions. Normative guidance, the ability to regulate our conduct and to talk with one another about the ways of regulation, is absolutely crucial to the ability of humans to cooperate on much broader scales, to live in much bigger societies, and so forth. So I like to put this by saying, you know, we're altruists, so we've always been able to live as social animals. We're limited altruists, so we haven't been able to live easily as social animals.
Mm-hmm.
We overcame some of those limitations by developing ethical practices.
That's okay. Speaking of social animals...
Yes.
Right. Thank you so much. So after sort of setting this stage and giving us some foundations for talking about values in general and how these are going to be central to the further elaboration of the theory and the suggestions for perhaps manifesting positive change from understanding that theory, you lead us into a discussion of democracy. Right, and democratic values in particular. You've already said a little bit about, and we've talked a little bit about democracy as being more than sort of just people with ink on their hands from going into the polls and voting. And you've talked a little bit about the centrality of Dewey for shaping your thoughts about this. One of the interesting things about this chapter in particular is that you make a case for the real problem of unidentified or unidentifiable oppression. This seems to be very important to the elaboration of this and for the justification of creating a system of public knowledge in order to undermine the existence and promulgation of or propagation of unidentifiable and unidentified oppression. Can you say a little bit about that?
Absolutely. One of my favorite themes, so I'd love to. There are lots of occasions in which people's lives are cramped and sometimes twisted and distorted, and they have no idea where it's coming from. They don't think of themselves as it were, suffering any kind of political oppression. And yet, you know, the fact that they have no schools to go to or dangerous schools to go to or educationally inadequate schools to go to, the fact that they have no protections against various kinds of health risks, those are things they just don't trace those as problems of oppression. Democracy, I think, was a wonderful, historically, a wonderful solution to a certain kind of problem. Problem of some heavy-handed being who was going around chopping people's heads off or taxing them to death or interfering in all sorts of rather obvious ways in their lives. So if you've got a being like that and you've got the ability to, as it were, express the public will at the polls, then you've got a device that counters that problem. What democracy isn't perfect with respect to that. I'm living in Germany at the moment, and the case of Germany in the 1920s and 30s is a sobering reminder that even in a democratic society, you may fail to see the dangers inherent in a certain form of tyranny. But it's It's been, I think, historically a pretty good solution to that problem. But in complex modern societies, there are all sorts of policies which are unsurveyable, sometimes even unsurveyable by the people who put them into effect, that have huge consequences for the course of people's lives. And those people have no sense of what it is that's confining them and how it's coming about. And they go to the polls and they vote blindly because they can't see what is, as it were, interfering with their lives the most. And that's the difficulty, I think, of much contemporary democracy. It's exemplified in things like the climate change debate. It's exemplified also in certain sorts of healthcare debates, biotechnology debates, and so forth. This is in some ways a more general problem than I portrayed in the book. I mean, there's a sense in which I'm, in this chapter, I'm working my way towards a Deweyan vision of democracy as a work of progress, in progress, that might be articulated across a far broader field than I actually deal with in the book. But the thought is that a system of public knowledge that can identify these kinds of difficulties is absolutely crucial for the health of a democracy. Otherwise, people's preferences will have nothing to do with what they really want, and they'll end up voting for candidates whose actions will be directly contrary to what they hope to achieve. I mean, we can see this happening in all sorts of ways in many countries at the moment, but perhaps nowhere so clearly as in the United States.
And I think one of, even though no single book can possibly give a fully elaborated account of all of the ways in which, or all of the consequences and all of the ways that any of these individual components of the theory might be elaborated, one of the great things about this is that it's drawing in readers who are interested in science, who are interested in science policy, who are interested in science studies and may not realize that a component of what they might be interested in is, you know, this problem of democratic values, which actually has a much wider set of literature that then you can go off to. So I don't think it doesn't read at all as if it's trying to give, you know, every explanation possible or to say everything it's possible to say, but it at least brings it into the discussion in a way that I think is very productive.
Well, it's an attempt to fuse some themes in science studies with a certain kind of social epistemology and with some very deep problems in political philosophy, political theory. And those, in both cases, those problems are really hard and really wide-ranging. And I wish that my fellow philosophers would spend more time and less time on some of the activities that they actually engage in.
Well, so one of the, as we move toward, so the way the book is, or the way the architecture of the book is set up for listeners, there are four chapters that set out sort of the basic foundations of this idea, and then chapters 5 through 8 sort of offer it an elaboration of a theory that works from these basic premises that's then sort of manifest in or embodied in particular examples of how that theory might inform specific debates in the final chapter in chapter 9. So one of the things that you talk about in chapter 4 is sort of perhaps the last of these foundation chapters is the importance of something that we've talked about very briefly before, which is the importance of contingency. And this is a place, again, where having a historical sensibility or a sensibility of the contingent nature of the development here of systems of public knowledge is going to be crucial for how you want us to think about how then to consider science in a democratic society. Can you speak a little bit about the importance of contingency? Because, again, this seems to be a crucial point of intersection for, or a point of conversation, potentially, for historians and philosophers.
Yeah, I actually think this is a general point. It holds not only of the system of scientific inquiry, but it's of lots of other institutions too. Right. That they evolve, if you like, sort of in response to particular demands of the and challenges of the environment. Particular things. I mean, this is something the science studies tradition, I think, has seen very, very clearly for a long time, and it's taken me a while to appreciate the ways in which the kind of knowledge seeking that is done in a particular era is immensely responsive to all sorts of things of other parts of the of life and the world at the time. And the result is that, you know, that you don't have any kind of planning of these institutions. They just evolve rather haphazardly. And then they can get in one another's way. There can be all sorts of friction between one institution and another. I think one of the frictions we're seeing at the moment is between the institution of scientific investigation and our economic institutions. So our economic institutions have evolved really sort of haphazardly in response to various kinds of crises that have occurred, in response to a particular kind of social experiment that was carried out in some regions of the world and allegedly faced a crashing defeat in around 1989, with the result that a certain version of the economic institutions that were around before has become highly dominant. That then gives rise to all sorts of constraints on large numbers of other sectors of human life, education, and on science. And we can see these things, as it were, shaping one another during the course of the last century, the last 20 years. And all of that is, in a certain sense, an irrational process. And that one of the great tasks of philosophy, I think, I think all sorts of thinkers have seen this. I think Marx saw it. I think Foucault saw it. I think Dewey saw it. Is actually to reflect on this, to reflect on the ways in which these contingent decisions express themselves and cause really deep difficulties in the circumstances of subsequent life. And what I'm concerned with here, of course, is the way in which the origins and development of a system of public knowledge really influence that system under completely different conditions. I'm very worried, of course, that that what I call this sort of ideal of disinterested curiosity, detachment from the projects of society, runs through contemporary scientists' self-understandings and their resistance to certain kinds of initiatives that might be beneficial for the broader health of democratic society.
This is actually something that I wanted to – this gets us right into something I wanted to ask you about and right into sort of the meat of your elaboration of this theory. How much – you talk about this in the book, but would you say a little about how much ought the research agenda of scientists be shaped by or be defined by public interest or practical problems of potentially public concern? So how much ought that play a role?
Well, I think that's a very hard question to answer in general. I think there are places where we can see very clearly that the research that is done is not representative of the needs of human beings. It's most evident in disease research, mm-hmm. where a large number of people's interests are completely neglected. I mean, the market is coming in and saying, well, okay, let's have research into things that the affluent want and that the affluent are prepared to pay for. So we'll have diet pills. Mm-hmm. We'll have various skin creams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What about the infectious diseases that affect the world's poor? Well, the world's poor don't pay. Tough. The world's poor don't get the things that they need for problems far more debilitating, far more damaging, have far higher rates of mortality. I mean, that's a place in which you can really see the mismatch between the research agenda and human needs. But I think in more subtle forms, that's actually in a lot of places. And of course, scientists don't like the idea of direct research. And I think it's worth taking their doubts into account insofar as those doubts are grounded in track records of failure. there are going to be, I mean, one can look systematically at cases in which people have attempted to direct research in various ways and try to learn some things about the failures of directed research and also about ways in which research might be profitably directed and ways in which it's not. This isn't really any kind of blank check for directing research. It's more a matter of stock-taking about it's a call for taking stock of what opportunities the existing state of science affords us for making further progress in various kinds of arenas, and what kinds of needs people have. And what we can learn from the historical record, again, history matters, about ways of responding to human needs. I mean, I'm quite open to the suggestion that a certain amount of autonomy might prove to be very valuable for some individual scientists if the historical record were to show, for example, that it's a good idea to let people who have particular hunches and a track record of brilliant initiatives just do what they want to do. Scrap those forms on which you have to fill out what you're going to do contributes to something for these people. You know, just let them do what they want to do. That's actually itself a perfectly pragmatic decision principle in line with the democratic things that I'm suggesting. But it's this idea that a kind of blanket autonomy for the scientist is a good thing that seems to me to need questioning and need thinking. So there's the account of how you mesh the concerns of the broader society with the concerns of the interests of the individual is a difficult and delicate one, and it's not to be settled a priori by saying, you know, well, we're just going to draw up a list of government priorities and everybody's going to do it, nor equally by saying, well, we're going to let the scientific community decide. The book makes concrete proposals about how to do this.
Absolutely. And part of those proposals get at the importance of learning and mutual learning. And so it's not just that scientists are learning from, or the research agendas of scientists might learn from more engagement with the public understanding of what they're doing and public concerns, but it's not the case that we should understand public understanding and public concerns to be something that's static and just out there. And in fact, one of the really interesting things that you're suggesting here are ways, and at various levels, and I want to ask you about two of them, for...
Say something about, just interrupt you a second. I think there are cases in which this mutual learning has gone on. Steve Epstein has this lovely book about how AIDS activists and the scientists doing AIDS research learn from one another.
Right.
And that's a beautiful example of how this can work. And it would be nice if we could make that happen on a much broader scale, I think.
Right. And one of the things, there are a couple of suggestions that you have here that are, I found very compelling and very interesting, and I'd like to talk with you about that. And this is learning on the other end of things. And so as a way to sort of help the transmission of if transmission is the right metaphor, the transmission of scientific information, data, et cetera, whatever you want to put in there, to a public, to sort of help the public make a more informed, have more informed engagement with the kinds of debates about science and democracy that we want to sort of aim for. And I should also say as a footnote to listeners that the public is not taken for granted here as a static concept. You also talk a lot about the sort of the multiplicity of that. And so we're not assuming the public is one kind of thing. But in order to affect that kind of greater understanding, you suggest a system whereby small groups of citizens would be tutored in particular areas of scientific inquiry. And you also suggest a revision of the science curricula in schools.
Yeah.
Both of these I found very interesting suggestions. Can you say a little bit about both or either one of these?
Yeah, I mean, when I wrote Science, Truth, and Democracy, I had this sort of philosopher's view. I was going to say, well, here's an ideal. I leave it to the political scientists and the sociologists to figure out how to implement this ideal to the extent it can be implemented. Along the way, I just became more and more dissatisfied with that. I don't think philosophers just get off easy with that. So I thought, well, is this something that even has a chance of being implementable? And I started looking at some of the work that had been done, and I was being very impressed by the work of the Stanford political scientist James Fishkin, who's run these sort of deliberative citizen groups. And it does seem to me that, I mean, he's had some remarkable successes. He's also had some issues which were not so successful. And it seems to me that his problem, in a certain sense, is how do we do this? And he has the expertise on that. What I want to do in the book is say, really, there are places that have not been recognized at which something like this needs to be done. But this is one way of getting communication. If you think that trust between the public, the broader public, outsiders, and the scientific community is threatened or even breaking down in some areas, then there are really two ways to go, which is one is to have huge educational effort so that the public can come to see that certain parts, at least possibly all of what the scientists are saying, is well justified. So that's, you might think of that as the movement from science out. And then there's the movement from the public in. Mm-hmm. And the Fishkin way is to, as it were, invite some people into the kitchen to see how the meal is cooked, or to invite some people backstage to see how the actors are prepared or made up and so forth. And I think with respect to some issues, they're so urgent, global warming most obviously, that we can't wait for a massive transmission of information effort from the scientific community out. This is probably the best way to make further progress in restoring trust between science and the public. So the role of the group is really to learn, to appraise, to criticize, to be exposed to debate, and then to come back and say, well, look, on some of these areas, at least, we're convinced that the community has gotten things right. And they've got to have sufficient standing. I mean, they mustn't be seen as having been indoctrinated, which makes for a very delicate problem if they're to serve as representatives of the public. But it seems to me that's a possible direction which one could go. For the education stuff, I think we do things very, very badly. And by we, I don't just mean American schools. I think that in general, there's a lot of science education that turns a lot of people off science for life, and they become more and more detached from the information they need. Mm-hmm. There's a certain kind of scientific education that's really necessary if students are going to find out whether science is for them, and probably everybody should go through that at some stage. But when it's become obvious to somebody, maybe at the age of 15, maybe even earlier than that, maybe a bit later than that, that what they're not going to do is become a research scientist, then forcing them to memorize, the periodic table or the list of amino acids, or to solve some problem using Ohm's law with electrical circuits is just counterproductive. What you want them to do is equivalent to what you want students to do when you teach them how to read a historical text or how to read a literary text. You want them to be interested in and excited by and able to read scientific texts. And so I see the possibility of a co-evolution of an educational program focused on scientific literacy and perhaps a new sort of journalism, which is sometimes prefigured by some of the most, wonderful exponents of science. And in the last decades, there have been some wonderful exponents. I mean, Steve Gould, Ed Wilson, Richard Dawkins, Carl Sagan, Brian Greene, Olivia Judson, Horace Judson. It goes on and on and on. This, good list of terrific people. And, you could have then the possibility of people having enough grasp of various kinds of basic scientific concepts that they could throughout their lives keep in touch with what's being found out about the issues that matter to all of us and the discoveries that are being made. That's a long-term project. It won't solve our immediate problems, which is why I suggest the supplementation with the as it were, the citizens being taken behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. I think one of, just as a kind of anecdote, I was recently reading about a project by an education school professor in Israel who was trying to develop a science curriculum for lower schools that integrated notions of local cultures of science into the curriculum by basically. Now, this is potentially problematic because it encourages thinking of traditions of science as being identifiable by nation states, right? But he's trying to incorporate ideas of sort of local creation of scientific knowledge, you know, science broadly conceived here, into lower school education in science, and supposedly having good luck with it. So it's another very interesting.
Well, I mean, I think actually students can learn a lot about science from learning things in the history of science.
Yeah.
I mean, there are all sorts of ways in which I think we could be far more imaginative in teaching people science than we are. Right. But there's far too much memorization focus and far too much toy problem focus for students who've already given up on the thought that this is going to be their path through life.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, some, and then I'll back off from this, but some areas of scientific inquiry are essentially historical disciplines, right, in a way. I mean, broadly conceived, telling stories about things, objects or individuals in the past. Right?
Yep.
I mean, this is evolutionary science in some form.
But, well, yes.
And I don't mean that as mere stories, yeah. Right? I don't mean that.
No. Mm-hmm. But there are very good and well-founded accounts of various kinds of evolution processes. That's right. Okay.
Absolutely. Well, Philip, there's so much more that we could talk about here. We've sort of blitzed through many of the last chapters. For listeners who haven't had a chance to read it, I mean, there are really fascinating discussions here of sort of the question of whether scientists should or should not be made to do what's ethically required of them. There are discussions of the role of sort of non-scientists in the certification of science. There's a really interesting discussion of what, you know, philosophers of science have to do professionally with all of this. And there's a really wonderful chapter at the end that gives very concrete examples of ways in which these issues play out and ways in which the theory that you're proposing here might inform the way we think about these areas. Is there anything in particular or maybe multiple things that we haven't had a chance to talk about that you want to make sure to mention for listeners who may not yet have had a chance to read the book?
One thing I would say is that I think there are three different contexts in which the relation between which science and society needs to be explored. One is in the context when the agenda of questions is being set. Another is in the context in which things are being certified. I think this is really a wonderful issue for philosophers to explore because certification is a social process. And there are all sorts of things that we want the certification to be reliable. We also want it to be seen to be reliable. And that causes all sorts of difficulties. And then there are these problems of transmission. I mean, I think one of the great problems for our age, we're awash in a certain sense in information, is to set up channels so that information can flow where it's needed. And that's really hard. Then there are questions about cooperation within science and the role of dissent within science. These are all, I think, fascinating topics that have a real bearing on how the sciences are used in our lives. Now, the book sprawls into, I'm afraid, it sprawls off into issues about democracy generally. And I shall have to attend to that.
No, it's wonderful. And it's this is also a book that I know I at least will be assigning to students in the future in all kinds of courses. And so it's a very teachable book as well. It's which is not often the case when you are looking at a philosophy of science book. I mean, I can imagine assigning this to advanced undergraduates even. So I hope this is also widely assigned in classrooms. But so now that,
I hope so too.
So what are you working on now? What are you most sort of passionately engaged with now that this book is out? And
it's really an attempt to go beyond this book and also the ethical project. I'm really interested in these issues about how various kinds of social institutions are potentially in conflict with one another. That's a kind of generalization of the theme that I'm taking up in science and democratic society. And I'm very interested in ways of thinking about the ethical ideals and the ideas of ethical conversation that I develop in the ethical project might be developed further and made more concrete. And so I've been spending this year in Berlin thinking in general about these issues and trying to develop a Deweyan pragmatism for the 21st century. And I have the structure, I think, in my head, but it'll take me probably a decade to work it all out. There's a lot that I need to know and I need to explore. It has connections with the things that are in science and democratic society as well as in the ethical project. I'm giving a sort of kind of progress report, have a collection coming out in the fall called Preludes to Pragmatism, which gives some sort of preliminary ideas about the direction I'm taking off from these books and where I've been. But full scale thing will take me a long time. As I said, I'm a very slow learner.
Well, it's well worth it, judging from this book. So thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today, Philip, and best of luck with your current project.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed talking to you.
You too. You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.